It's really a privilege to introduce very old dear friend Mirabai Bush. Mira's in the past spent many years in India and Asia in various forms of practice, including our own. At present, she's the director of the Seva Action, Seva Project Action Group for Guatemala. And she's been working many years now with the indigenous Mayan people of that country. She's also the author, with Ram Dass, of Compassion in Action. And she's on various planning boards, including Sustaining Compassion, Sustaining the Earth, which provides the environment for retreats for environmental activists. Also, she's on various planning boards for Revolution of Hope, changing the world from the inside out. She presents really the embodied Dharma of service, and it's really a privilege to be able to share in her experience and her the vastness of her heart and knowledge. She's also teaching a series of workshops and retreats on women's spirit and social action. Welcome, Mira.
Hello, everybody. It's wonderful to be in this room. I know you're going to miss it. I have been doing this for a number of years, I wasn't here last year, but many years, coming at the end of the retreat and talking about taking the practice out into the world, mainly because I get the luxury of being in the world the 3 months. Well, I do my 3-month course in the world while you're all sitting. And can you hear me in the back? A little bit, does that mean?
No, it means good.
Oh, it means good, okay. So tonight I wanted to talk about... about that re-entry into a different kind of world than you've been experiencing here. And I thought, as you know, there's so many things to talk about a world that is based so much more on relationship with others, with other beings, with the world itself, with the planet, than the world in which you're in relationship with your own mind and heart and internal space here. And I thought it might be nice to hear from a few of you before I start, to just maybe you would tell me a theme that is on your mind these days as you're beginning to think about leaving Barrie and going to your next place. I'll try to work those into. I find the form of one person talking for an hour and other people listening. I know you're very used to it by now, but it's very particular and special to this environment. But in general, I always find that in the world of talking, that we learn more through dialogue or through interconnection, through weaving together something that we create, all of us together. And it's not practical, I understand, in this setting, but I thought it might be at least nice if a few of you would just state a theme, a fragment, whatever. Yes?
I used to be very active in politics, mainly motivated by anger. And I got sort of burned out on that. And Stephen Levine, a few years ago, introduced to me this idea of being motivated by compassion. And I kind of get it in terms of feeling compassion for individuals or poor people or whatever, but to what I can't see is how you would have that level of a normal person's not a Martin Luther King or something, they have that level of compassion that would sort of get you up every day, 3 a.m. to write those manifestos and get those position papers out, particularly in something like politics where you're not directly involved with unfortunate people you're able to help or whatever. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about how do you really not just have compassion, but have such a high level of compassion that you actually really get out there and are politically and socially active on a day-to-day basis.
I'm trying to bring it forward. It's the single most asked question by activists is how one is motivated if one is to give up one's anger. Okay. Yes.
Fragments.
Just a brief
that's what,
fragment.
That's what's happened. Now I'm a fragment right here. taking myself too seriously, thinking that I have to be important in the world,
yes.
A place where we can begin to go into being communities that are happening farther and
a place we can begin to go, interbeing communities.
Yeah, interbeing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm using.
Yeah.
But are there any in the United States?
Are there places to go in the United States?
Yeah.
Yes?
Keeping the silence and the peace within while you're active in the world.
Yes?
How to find a balance between work in the world and turn it inward.
Yes?
Guatemala is very dear to my heart. Uh-huh. My daughter works with that too. But the hardest thing for me to manage, to whatever, is to give up the anger, to give up the anger. But we know it's happening in Guatemala and all the other places. When you see that directly in the highlands, Altiplano, Guatemala, how do you do that? You work with the widows.
Yes?
You can speak something to how to act, how to have the courage to act when you know that your actions aren't coming, that potentially your actions aren't coming from a very peaceful place.
Deciding between deepening understanding and when it's appropriate to go, and then utilize that understanding and compassion. In other words, it's almost the choice between practice and service.
Yes.
I also, I think, would like to hear about your experience in Guatemala. I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer from Belize, and my wife is from Belize, was part of it. I lived a mile from the Guatemala border while I was there. I'm very much aware of the extreme violence in the history of the country and how you relate, go about relating learning from them, and, just existing in that kind of environment and trying to do compassion work.
Right. So, did you have something?
Having to deal with sort of like the shocking thoughts of all the genetic codes of all the animals that are disappearing every month.
Something about choosing a place and a way of service. There's opportunities right at home, and then there's this tendency of judging how much suffering, shopping for the worst.
Mm-hmm. I went to a conference while you were sitting. It was called Beyond a Hierarchy of Oppressions. Well, if you all stayed together as a single unit, you would have, obviously, all the questions around action in the world and the interplay between wisdom and compassion all happening. And we know that there aren't any answers. There's experience that informs the wisdom that emerges out of the questions. And we know that it's really that it's the continual reforming of the questions that is our work, and the looking and the listening. But it's really wonderful to hear the themes and questions, the perennial wisdom. You know, I'll try to allow these in particular to come through what I'm going to say, and we have to finish at 8:30. But if there's anybody who'd like to stay later, I'll be happy to do it, especially if you want to talk about something specific like Guatemala or so on. I made some notes. And I brought a few things to read. And I liked this as an opening poem for re-entering. This sense you'll have of yourself as somehow the same person, but in some other ways, not the same person at all. This is a poem by a poet named Martín Espada. He's near here at UMass. It's a poem called Fidel in Ohio. The bus driver tore my ticket and gestured at the tabloid spread across the steering wheel. The headline, Fidel Castro, dead, replaced by identical double. Below, two photographs of Fidel, one with cigar, one without. The resemblance is amazing, the driver said. And I agreed. One thing I always think about coming from the, quote, outside in, at the end of the three-month course, I always feel, and I think that I carry for you a feeling, whether conscious or not, of others who haven't been here, a feeling of great gratitude for the kind of work that you all have been doing during this time. You know, no matter how well you think you've done it. The very intention of working toward more consciousness, of becoming more aware, of opening the heart, whether you thought as you entered that you were doing it for the good of all beings or not, in fact, we know that it's an inevitable consequence. And I just always feel this extraordinary gratitude that, you know, that some of us are doing it, that some of us are trying to get more clear and that are trying to get closer to the truth, because I believe that if, as any one of us gets closer, that, or in any moment, I don't mean to say that it's a linear road down which, or up which, you are traveling, but you know, it's both inspiring and it is really, it brings into the central great consciousness of which we and all species are part, a little more awakening, a little more spaciousness, a little more truth. I always also feel, because I know that there's a kind of anxiety that comes, because the world we live in now is, it's very difficult. And there's an anxiety of returning to being in relationship, in active relationship to it all. But there's another, and one doesn't just have that after 3 months of sitting. I mean, many people have it upon awakening every morning. But there's, I think, important in terms of the way in which we're all creating our own story, and together we're all creating the story for now, to remember that that you'll be re-entering a world that's in a really interesting process right now, and a process that, I mean, if you could say that a culture ever needed, you know, people carrying the Dharma more or less, I mean, certainly it's really needed now. That my experience of, I asked Steve to mention those various things I'm engaged in to let you know that I've been spending a lot of time with people of all different kinds of activists, of many environmental activists, but a lot of people working on inner city work and international work, and a lot of people who aren't social activists but who are working on changes in consciousness, or it is beginning to be more and more clear that we're in a time in which the world is really in a process of redefining the sacred. I mean, I have a 21-year-old son who lives in the Lower East Side and is a film student at NYU. And they are very busy being postmodernists. They took me, he and his friends recently, I went to New York and they took me to, this is a compassionate act on their part, they took me to St. Mark's Books and they stood me in front of the main section when you first walked in, and this, the whole section on postmodernism. And I was in graduate school till I was 30. I was into the world of books. But I stood in front of these this display. I didn't recognize a single author. I didn't understand any of the titles. And they said, Mom, you have to do this. You have to read these books, because if you don't, then there's going to be a whole part of who we are that just doesn't overlap anymore. And we will miss you. So, now, they're talking about things like that I still don't get, even after reading the books, that have to do with virtual reality and worlds past meaning, and worlds in which the understanding is that, try this one, everything has already happened, or it could have, therefore, dot, dot, dot. I mean, but there's another sense of postmodern in which we've been looking at the way in which a kind of postmodern spirituality, in which the end of the modern period, which has been the rational, linear, hierarchical, dare I say, patriarchal understanding of the world, is winding down. The change, of, as we know, has been being led by scientists, because you have to be led out of one period by the heroes of that period. But what's happening is that the new understanding of the world is entirely harmonious with certain perennial, ancient, eternal truths, which happen to come through Buddhism as well as through many other channels. And those things that we've set aside and have almost lost the appreciation for the interconnection of all things, and for the aspects of wisdom that include intuition and connection with nature and appreciation of community through the interconnection of all things. We start in our yearning for the return of those. It's time to bring together certain traditional and eternal understandings with what we learned during this kind of modern period, so that we know this, we're entering a new time. And there's an amazing rebirth of spirit through many different channels and places, and that the more tuned you are to the process of awakening, I find, the more that you see it in different places, and the more you find the yearning for it in the culture. It's interesting that a kind of work that you may feel that you've been doing on yourself or in yourself or with yourself, that that we're seeing that it is exactly the kind of work we've been doing here that is being yearned for, that kind of truth, in our attempt to live in a different way on the planet. That what we've been learning inside ourselves is part of what we need for the healing outside ourselves. And so that when we re-enter and are faced with the extraordinary suffering that's happening in the world right now, it's interesting. It seemed that every fall, some major catastrophe happens. I remember 2 years ago, coming in here, and the Gulf War had happened, and nobody knew it. I felt like this was the only group of people in the country who had missed it, you know? I won't say that, you know, that there was anything that dramatic this year, but I know that when you go back, that you will feel that there's a sense of agitation on the planet right now that is very hard to live with. I during this 3 months also, I did a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, called it Love in Action. It was a retreat for social change, it was called. And I'm sure many of you have sat with him over time. But he gave a gatha, he calls it, that I have found is very helpful in being in situations where there's a lot of suffering. And that is, he says, breathing in, I have arrived. Breathing out, I am home. And it turns out that it works everywhere. I thought that Of all the teachings that that the Buddha has given us, and that I know you've all been reflecting on during your time of practice, that I find that the biggest difference between sitting and working in the world, which is another form of practice, the biggest difference is that I find that I need to focus more on the precepts when I am, quote, in the world. If we were fully mindful at every moment, and that mindfulness was informed by wisdom and compassion fully, we really wouldn't need any guidelines. That the truth of every moment is totally present in the moment, and we would always know what to do. But as we know, it's a process, and we're not always completely there at every time. And because there's so many competing demands on our awareness in a complicated world, that I find that the precepts start becoming really important. And that in that both in our work as livelihood and in our work in social action, I know that you're not all going to go out and be immediately engaged in full-time social action. I like to talk about it because I think that it's an inevitable part of everybody's life now, because it's once one's heart opens through this practice, it's impossible to be in the world now and not experience other people's suffering. And once that happens and you feel compassion, then the natural next breath is action for the relief of suffering. So one way or another, I know you will all be exposed to it and engaged in it. The same process, of course, happens in our livelihood and our relationships. The precepts I think of, I was spending a lot of time with Native Americans, and the precepts are kind of what the Native Americans call walking your talk. You know, it's showing through your action what it is that you are glimpsing through your insight. The first, as you, I thought I'd talk about them and give you some examples of the way that they come up and the way that they can really bring your practice to life. It's really important once you're in the world to of course allow the distinction between sitting practice, which we need to continue to return to, both in daily life and in retreats, and in the rest of our life. But it's also simultaneously important not to make a distinction between one being, you know, life in the Dharma and one not. So I just wanted to try to bring to life the way in which the not sitting practice can be, can bring us to mindfulness and awareness at every moment. The first precept, as you know, is, I used to think of it as not killing. I kind of swept by it usually because I rarely had had the impulse, rarely, probably never, to kill anybody. And I thought it was pretty easy. I now think of it in a much broader and almost reversed way, in that it really has to do with cultivating a reverence for life and supporting the life force and making choices for life on earth whenever they present themselves, which turns out to be really fairly regularly in our lives. It leads us to ask questions like, you know, when our government does participate in the killing of other people, what is our responsibility? It's really interesting. During these months, the New Yorker ran a long article on El Salvador and on a massacre that happened in El Salvador. It happened 10 years ago. Nobody reported it then. There were some small mentions. The New Yorker gave a whole issue to it this fall. They thought it was important to do now because it was important to reflect on, at the end of the Cold War, if we were holding the communists responsible for looking at their mistakes and failures, that we should also do that. But whenever we looked at these facts, what was revealed was that the United States had trained and funded and been largely responsible for, in this particular case, a whole village of largely old people, women and children, being killed. If we really take this precept seriously, we really have to ask, in all these cases, that's one small one, I mean, of course, recently the Gulf War was another, What is our responsibility? You know, in what way have we taken those lives, you know? If we are part of a democracy, which is supposedly a conscious coming together of persons, all of whom are participating, in what way have we made that decision? And what can we do in the moment? There's very little one can do. But what is it that we have to do? In what way do we have to lead our lives differently so that we don't participate in leading toward the taking of life? Just last week, there was on the commuter train in Long Island, a man took out a gun and shot a whole bunch of people who were just going home from work. It was a complicated psychological story, of course, when it was all revealed. But the major theme in it was racism. He was black. All the people he killed were white and Asian. You know, two people tackled him and stopped him from killing more people. That's the first level. But the deeper level is us asking ourselves questions about how we participate in a system, in a culture, in a life, in a family that that perpetuates that, that leads to it. And what can we do each moment and each day in which to change it? Because we know that change comes from each one of us changing, you know. There are endless examples of choices against life that are happening, that in some way or other, because we that we are participating in. And how can we take the consciousness and the awakening and the love that develops in the sitting practice and bring it out? There was a piece the other day on how that the prediction now is in San Francisco in the gay male community that AIDS is rising again. You know, it's a very steep drop once there was so much public health education. But there's now, it's interesting because it's like a group consciousness phenomenon in that many people have expressed a kind of emotional burnout from having lost so many friends. Having lost so many friends and so many that they couldn't grieve for them. That and then the taking away of the physical pleasure of sex as we knew it before AIDS. That people are so overwhelmed by what has happened and have not somehow been able to look at it, process it, come to clarity about it, that even though probably, you know, 99% of everybody in that community knows exactly what's needed to do to prevent AIDS, that people have stopped doing it. I found that very touching. How are each one of us related to all these things? These are questions that I know will come up for you as you re-enter with this kind of, you know, really heightened sensitivity that you're going to bring out. It of course brings up the concept of nonviolence, and that's something that, you know, practicing nonviolence in a violent society is it's a very challenging path. I just wanted to share one thing that I saw that I think that really putting ourselves in situations where we can continue to challenge it and play it at the edge will really help us understand more deeply and to be able to share with other people. have been working in Guatemala, and I've been working in village development. And recently, the refugees from Mexico have started returning to Guatemala. And so a group that we've been working with there asked us if we, at Seva Foundation, if we would participate in accompaniment for the returned refugees. We've never done anything like that. Doing accompaniment is making a pretty, in Guatemala, bold political statement. It's saying that accompaniment is when you just take your body and place it next to somebody's, and by just doing that very act, you are providing a kind of safety for them. I kind of like it because we as North Americans carry a sense of privilege and entitlement just by being North Americans, and it can be recognized. And so if we put ourselves next to a Guatemalan who's in danger, just from being there, seems very Buddhist to me. I like this. But but we hadn't done anything like this before. And so a group of people said they were interested in doing it. And we went out into the woods in Northern California, and a friend who'd been working, who was experienced in this, he'd worked with a group called Peace Brigades for years, went with us, and we did what's called a training. And we did a role play to act out what might happen there. And one thing that might happen is that a North American would be accompanying a Guatemalan returned refugee who would have to go back to her village to get her papers. So they'd be on the road together. So we acted this out, and one person volunteered to be the Guatemalan and another to be the North American. Some other people were kind of walking down the road or standing around. They were kind of innocent bystanders. And some of us had rehearsed ahead of time. We had a van, and we were going to disappear, as they say in Central America, this Guatemalan. We were going to be a death squad, and we were going to grab the Guatemalan person, take her away. And so I was one of those people. Well, at first it was kind of funny, you know, being part of the death squad, because we talked about anger. That's been a major practice, the practice of compassion for the Guatemalan military and the death squads, of trying to put myself in the place of a person who might do those things. It's been very difficult, and to try to not exclude those people from the great web of interbeing, of which we're all a part. But I know that that's what we need to do, while at the same time standing against everything they're doing. So I was one of those people, and we rehearsed, and what we had to do was, I and another person were going to grab this person as she walked past our van. We're going to throw her in the back of the van, grab these plastic machine guns, hold back everybody else, and then jump in the van and take off. And we did it. We did the whole thing. We grabbed the person and put her back there. The whole thing was quite extraordinary. It took about 45 seconds. And we were gone, and the person was gone. And we knew that if it had been Guatemala, that person would never be seen again. But I tell you that being on the other side of the gun was so extraordinary. I saw that what happened was that I had talked myself into, I was trying to get into the mind state of an army person, and I was telling myself that this person was a real danger and threat to the future of Guatemala, and that a communist, you know, and that we had to get rid of this person. And I was doing that, and I grabbed her, and in doing that, I got this incredible rush of adrenaline, I guess, because there was a presence of violence and fear in the air, even though it was only play, that we all got into it. And What happened was that I forgot to pick up my gun, and somebody else filled in for me, and we got away. But I saw that if when you're doing that kind of action, that if you let anything real enter, any emotion or any feeling or any relationship with the other person as a whole human being, that you can't do that. And then I realized that what people need to do in order to play that role, as it were, is they have to block all of that. And in doing that, I mean, you know, you've been sitting all this time, you know that what we're about is trying to not block any of it, to let it all arise and fall away so that we can see it all. And I got such an appreciation of the pain, which I could never really, I mean, I could say that I did, but I've had a very great struggle in having a real intimate appreciation for the pain of people who do these things. But so I don't urge you all to do role play, but I urge you to allow yourself to explore the complexities of what nonviolence means for us in this culture at this time. You know, not this culture, this planet, you know, which has become so violent. I think it's really central to who we need to be. The second precept, which is not to steal, again, I'm sure you haven't had too many opportunities to come up against that in its raw state here, unless you've lusted after somebody's shoes or something. But the implications of that, of course, again, for us are, you know, very deep and very interesting and important to explore. That it, you know, it has to do with our both looking at how we've participated in, you know, all kinds of forms of social injustice. Injustice meaning some people like taking more than they need, or, you know, that we're not making, that we're not creating a society where everybody has basic human needs. That the implications for it have to do with generosity and giving. And, you know, they're broad. There's so much to think about. I was, not long ago, there was a meeting, gathering at my house of this group that was planning a retreat for people in the environmental justice movement. That people in that movement are the folks, the part of the environmental movement that have to do with, who are most concerned with the influence of environmental degradation on human beings and on communities, and the way in which, the abuse of the environment has most affected poor people and people of color. Frequently, toxic dumping is happening in their communities, next to their communities, and so on. There are a number of Native Americans in the movement who have been trying to protect their reservation lands. And this was a gathering of people of many different spiritual traditions. And there were African Americans and Native Americans and Asian Americans, and et cetera. They were all Americans. And I live here in Western Massachusetts, and it was about a month ago, and it was the end of the harvest season. The man I live with is a chef, and he had cooked up all the root vegetables that were left. We were having rutabagas and potatoes and carrots, and we were sitting around the dining room table, and somebody said, "This is great. This is just like Thanksgiving." And I was sitting next to this great Native American friend who also has a good sense of humor, as well as a good sense of history. And he said, so this person said, just like Thanksgiving, he said, we call it Thanks-taking. But it reminded me of another, some other women friends I'd done a women's circle with talked about that Native women often do a circle with women called the Women of the Four Colors, and they do the four directions and the four colors. And then in this case, they were going around, and each of the four women was making an offering at the end, and they were each singing a song from their traditions. And as we know, there's, and I think it's very reflected in our being so drawn to Buddhism. Buddhism, of course, is in the practice of mindfulness and insight. Is a practice that any of us with any other tradition, spiritual or cultural tradition, can use to increase wisdom, compassion, and insight. But there's been a very strong attraction for people in this country because so many of us have felt that we were left without, that we did not inherit a tradition that we could, that gave us a spiritual depth we could relate to. And so, in this group, they went around the group, and the women of the other colors each offered something from her tradition. And then the white woman, who, I don't know anything more about her, but they were each to sing a song, and she was kind of groping around for something. And she thought of a really great folk song, and from one of our great folk composers, Woody Guthrie, and she sang, "This land is my land," and her Native American sister said to her, "I wish you wouldn't." All of this. Is only to say that in using the precepts to come to awakening, that, you know, stealing leads us to the bigger questions that we need to ask, like the proper use of resources, issues around consumerism, about how much is enough, about, and it leads us immediately to the way in, you know, this country, what the common karma and heritage we have is of stealing the land from Native Americans and stealing a whole culture of Africans and bringing them here. I'm bringing up such big issues only to say that, you know, there never needs to be a moment in consciousness where the teachings won't lead you into the deepest questions you can ask in terms of who we are together as a large community. There's not much more time, and I don't want to just skip over sexual misconduct, but there's a lot to be said about it, not for it, but one thing, the serious part has to do with, with the values, lest we call them family values, but the values of holding our families and communities together and the way that we can bring harm into that through sexual misconduct. That's a whole subject. But one thing we might touch on here is the way in which we can take our kind of embodied spirit and our physical, the joy of physically being in our bodies into so many forms of expression. This is a This is a poem by a woman poet named Tess Gallagher, and I loved it, and I had an almost identical experience to this in New York. I was walking down the street, and there was a man there on the corner, and he looked kind of indigent, homeless. He had it crumpled in his hand. He had just been released from a detox situation, and he had been given some money to get to the next place he was supposed to go, another hospital or halfway house or something. He needed another $5, so he stopped me and engaged me in this conversation, showed me the papers, and I gave him the $5, and then we'd had a nice exchange through it. He told me it had been a struggle, and he was scared to be out on the street too long, and he was an older guy, and he'd been clearly on the street for a long time, and he came out of alcohol detox, and he looked like he'd had a pretty hard time. And he said, could I hug you? And you know, my immediate impulse was to say, of course, you know. But then, like halfway through it, I thought, fuck, excuse me, that I'm like, on the street in New York, what am I doing, you know? And then I was kind of embarrassed. I was all by myself, you know, and I left him, and I thought, gee, I wonder, you know? And then, I mean, I figured there were people who would have told me that probably wasn't a good idea. But, then I read this poem, and the same thing happened to her. It's great. A woman is reading a poem on the street, and another woman stops to listen. We stop, too, with our arms around each other. The poem is being read and listened to out here in the open. Behind us, no one is entering or leaving the houses. Suddenly, a hug comes over me, and I'm giving it to you, like a variable star shooting light off to make itself comfortable, then subsiding. I finish, but keep on holding you. A man walks up to us, and we know he hasn't come out of nowhere, but if he could, he would have. He looks homeless because of how he needs. Can I have one of those, he asks you? And I feel you nod. I'm surprised. Surprised you don't tell him how it is that I'm yours, only yours, etc., exclusive as a nose to its face. Love, that's what we're talking about. Love that nabs you with for me only and holds on. So I walk over to him, and I put my arms around him and try to hug him like I mean it. He's got an overcoat on, so thick I can't feel him past it. I'm starting the hug and thinking, how big a hug is this supposed to be? How long shall I hold this hug? Already, we could be eternal. His arms falling over my shoulders, my hands not meeting behind his back. He is so big. I put my head into his chest and snuggle in. I lean into him. I lean my blood and my wishes into him. He stands for it. This is his, and he's starting to give it back. So well, I know he's getting it, this hug. So truly, so tenderly, we stop having arms, and I don't know if my lover has walked away or what, or if the woman is still reading the poem, or the houses. What about them, the houses? Clearly, a little permission is a dangerous thing. But when you hug someone, you want it to be a masterpiece of connection, the way the button on his coat will leave the imprint of a planet in my cheek when I walk away, when I try to find some place to go back to. telling the truth or not telling lies. So many things to say. One thing I've found is important now is doing what we can to create a space of safety for others to tell the truth. Partly we do that by being brave enough to tell the truth ourselves, which isn't just saying the right answer, but it's really, I think, naming things as we see them. And sometimes taking a risk in naming something that might inspire someone else to do it. But also cultivating, you know, really deep listening, so that really it allows other people to feel safe enough to say their truth. I've seen this so much recently, people's fear of speaking in so many ways. But one, Paul Gorman, who's of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and is on listener-sponsored radio in New York, asked me to do a radio program with him on women and safety. And on the radio, we said, we had an hour, we said, we're going to create here a safe space in which only women will call in, and you can, we brought up some themes, and you can say whatever you want to. And we're going to create a space of listening that we hope that will invite you in. This is a longer thing to tell, but what we did was, instead of being a call-in program where people like call in and say their thing and hang up, we asked each person who called in to stay on the line. And we made this kind of circle of people who had said something. And it was so interesting. I mean, I've heard it, we all have many times, but on the air, it somehow rung out. Almost everybody who spoke said, I usually have a very hard time speaking. I never speak out like this. I'm usually afraid to say this, but I'm embarrassed to say this, but. And then they said very beautiful, touching, true things. And at the end, we had this circle of 10 people. Silence. You couldn't see it. You could certainly feel it. And only by putting out the intention that that was to be a safe place where people could say what they needed to say about this, we allowed something to be said that might not otherwise have been said. So I just offer that as something to carry with you that seems to be something that we need in the world. And with the quality of vulnerability that you carry when you've been doing so much practice, that you can create that for other people, because you have that, you have a capacity for listening now that you'll be carrying out into the world with you. We have one more minute. I would also, we don't want to skip over intoxicants, and so I will tell you that the New York Times reported that 5.5 million Americans are now taking a drug called Prozac that makes you happy all the time. And everybody who's taking it says they will never stop taking it. They also said that they are no longer creative, but they're willing to give it up. In order to keep all this alive, someone brought up in the beginning, and I know you've all been wondering, that what we all need and what the Buddha reminded us that we need is community or sangha or the extended family. And I'm sure it's been said And I'll say again, I encourage you to find it however you can, to join existing community, to community of people who are on the path in one way or another. All your communities may not be people who are sitting Vipassana every day, but you want to find community that will support you in leading a life according to the precepts, according to what you know in your deepest place is right. If you can't find community, to create community. And one thing is to try in the community you find for yourself to remember how important that diversity is in community. Just like, as environmentalists, we've been looking at the way, the mirroring that we all know now how important diversity is for the whole ecosystem, that how every animal who disappears, or every, I don't think any insects have disappeared yet, but every river and so on, that we lose something, we not only lose that species, but we lose something that's part of ourselves and the way that we are all interconnected, that's mirrored in our own, in our human communities, and that we desperately need diversity in our community. We need it in age. I've been in more groups recently that really brought in young people into a space of real respect and inclusion, old people, diversity in gender and in race and in culture and in spiritual background. These things will help us awaken in ways that we can't even guess. So I wish you
thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.